From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Ken Tucker, sitting in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, television writer David Mills. He's written the teleplay for an episode of ER that's airing tonight. He takes us behind the scenes of high-powered dramas like ER and NYPD Blue and discusses what it's like to be one of the few black writers and producers in major network television. And does the thought of biting off the head of a tarantula and scarfing it down make you a tad queasy? That didn't stop writer-photographers Peter Menzel and Faith DeLuzio from traveling the world consuming insects for their new book, Man-Eating Bugs. It gives new meaning to the phrase, "That's good grub." That and more coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Arab states are urging Baghdad to abide by Security Council resolutions to avoid a military attack. Meanwhile, a second batch of UN humanitarian workers left Iraq today as the United States continues to build up military might in the Persian Gulf. Dale Gavlak reports from Cairo.
Egypt, Syria, and six Gulf Arab states say if Baghdad doesn't heed UN resolutions, only it and it alone will be to blame for the consequences. Arab foreign ministers issued a communique from Qatar calling on Iraq to abandon its decision and cooperate fully with ANSCOM to reach a diplomatic solution to the crisis over arms inspections. Earlier, Iraq's UN ambassador, Nizar Hamdoun, said a peaceful resolution could be achieved through direct talks between Baghdad and UN Secretary General Kofi Annan. But Security Council member France says Annan will not go to Baghdad to broker a compromise. Five U.S. warships are speeding to the Gulf and are expected to cross the Suez Canal next week to beef up the already formidable U.S. military presence there. For NPR News, I'm Dale Gavlak in Cairo.
Five British judges will decide the fate of former Chilean dictator Augusto Pinochet. He's been held by British authorities for a month at the request of Spain. Spanish judges want to investigate Pinochet's role in the torture and murder of Spanish civilians in Chile. Running street battles swept through Jakarta today in the worst violence since Tuesday when the Special Assembly drafting new political laws convened. NPR's Julie McCarthy reports from Jakarta.
In scenes reminiscent of the violence that swept former President Suharto from power in May, police today fired water cannon and tear gas at thousands of student demonstrators converging on Parliament to demand faster political reform. Dozens are believed to have been injured in the confrontation that has become one of the worst political crises for the government of President BJ Habibi. Buses and cars were destroyed in the melee just a quarter of a mile from the Parliament that has been sealed since the start of the extraordinary assembly. Inside, delegates, mostly holdovers from Suharto's tenure, debated how to hold the former president accountable for alleged corruption and how to reduce the military's power in Parliament. But the violence on the streets outside seemed to make their discussions all but irrelevant. This is Julie McCarthy, NPR News, Jakarta.
News reports say the United States is prepared to sign the Global Warming Treaty, but the World Pact will still need to be ratified by the U.S. Senate for it to affect the United States. It's not clear that senators will approve it. The accord calls for major cuts in greenhouse gas emissions by the United States and 37 other industrial countries. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 64 points at 88.87. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, blue-chip stocks are showing signs of strength while analysts debate whether another interest rate cut by the Federal Reserve is in the cards. NPR's Jack Spear has this live report.
The blue chips continue to show some optimism ahead of next week's scheduled meeting by the Federal Reserve Board, though the broader market has been lagging somewhat. While some analysts say a stabilization in global markets may be lessening the likelihood of a Fed rate cut next week, others say they expect the body to trim rates for the third time in 8 weeks when the Fed meets Tuesday. The government, meanwhile, reports jobless claims last week rose by 12,000 to their highest level since the summer. Oil giants Atlantic Richfield, Texaco, and Mobil announced they are cutting jobs. They blame the current slump in prices amid a global glut of crude oil. Texaco says it will trim 1,000 jobs, Atlantic Richfield 900. Mobil has yet to say how many jobs it will cut. And discount retailer Ames announced today it's buying the Hills department store chain for $330 million. Jack Spear, NPR News, Washington.
A survey of economists predicts the American economy will perform well next year. 29 private sector economists were surveyed by the National Association for Business Economics. Their report: do not expect a recession next year. The economists say the U.S. economy may be slower than it was, but it's still growing. New studies suggest that diet drugs Redux and Fen-Phen may not pose a severe heart risk after all. These drugs were pulled from store shelves a year ago at the behest of the Food and Drug Administration. There was fear users could damage their heart valves. Now, there are 13 studies following the matter. They suggest that heart problems are less common than feared. Again on Wall Street, the Dow was up 64 points. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Borders Books and Music, offering a world to explore through books and music. Location information, 800-644-7733.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Ken Tucker. A few years ago, my guest David Mills was a staff writer for The Washington Post, where he wrote important pieces about black music. His interview with Sister Souljah became a factor in Bill Clinton's presidential campaign. Then he made a career switch. He became a writer for one of the most highly acclaimed shows on television, NYPD Blue, and was nominated for an Emmy Award. He's also contributed to ER. In fact, an episode for which he wrote the teleplay, entitled Hazed and Confused, airs tonight. Here's an excerpt from an ER that Mills wrote last season. In it, Dr. Mark Green, played by Anthony Edwards, is being questioned at a hearing about possible racism in his handling of a patient.
Did you feel horrible after Kenny Law died, after being treated by you in this hospital?
I felt regret, yes.
Had you applied the same standard of care to Kenny Law as to the white teenager brought into the emergency room 5 minutes before?
Yes.
It's a damn lie.
Oh, Miss Davis, do something
Chris,
about your client, please. Be quiet.
But you're in no position to accuse me of anything.
You, of all people.
Dr. Green, do you hold the life of a young black man to be of lesser value than the life of a white person?
What kind of a question is that?
Will you answer it?
People die. I'm human. I'm fallible.
So you would characterize yourself as fallible.
Don't twist my words.
Let me ask you about your fallibility. When this young black man was brought into the ER...
Look, you want me to say that I'm a racist? Is that it? I'm a racist, all right? Does that make you feel better about almost beating me to
Mark,
death?
Mark, sit down and
is
shut up.
Is that going to bring your son back?
Hey, don't you point your finger at my mother.
That's it. We are taking a break. We're stopping this right now.
Talking about regret. Regret. You never expressed no regret to my mother.
You belong in jail.
I wish it was me who kicked your white ass.
David Mills, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you very much, Ken, for having me.
So, how did you make this move from newspaper journalist to big-time TV writer?
It was quite a fluke, and whenever I tell aspiring TV writers about it, I mean, my heart breaks a little because I doubt that anybody can duplicate it. A newspaper buddy of mine from college, David Simon, had written the book Homicide.
Mm-hmm.
And when they turned that into a show, they gave him one of the first episodes to write almost as a courtesy, and that was back in 92. And for old time's sake, Simon brought me along, and we wrote that script together as a lark.
Uh-huh.
And it became the episode that they hired Robin Williams to do, and they launched their second season with it. And it awakened in me a kind of dormant desire to write for TV anyway. So I took the opportunity and left the Washington Post and got an agent and to see if I could make a go of it, quite prepared to go back to journalism if I couldn't make a go of it.
Yeah, I mean, in my experience, lots of people think, a writer's a writer. If you can write for a newspaper, you can write a script. Could you please disabuse people of this notion?
Well, I don't know that I can from my own experience, because I think storytelling is storytelling.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the things you have to know in journalism apply in drama as well. I mean, as a journalist, you're devoting a lot of thought. Or at least I did. You know, you write a long feature. If you write a long feature, a disproportionate amount of energy is going into, you know, how to start the story, how to get people hooked, you know, how to get them reading past the jump, you
mm-hmm.
know, how to get them reading to the end, how to keep them reading, how to have surprises in the thing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what TV writing is, too. You got to keep people interested to the end. You know, you've got to tell a story. I think it was, I mean, if I had tried to write TV at the age of 24 and not 34, you know, I don't think, forget life experience, I don't think I would have had the storytelling chops
mm-hmm.
that come with that come with feature writing and newspaper work.
So what did you do? Did you write a spec script? How did you go about getting an agent?
Yes, I did. I had to write a spec script because the piece I had written with David Simon, that homicide piece, biggest splash as it made, was useless as a writing sample for me because we had written it as a team.
I see.
And because he was doing another book, The Corner, we couldn't come into the TV business as a team, so I wrote an NYPD blue spec, as a matter of fact.
So it was useless in the sense that people said, well, we don't know what's your work and what's Simon's work?
Exactly. Yeah. It was useless even in getting an agent. Agents didn't care, because they would say the same thing. We don't know who wrote what. You have to write something yourself.
Yeah.
So I wrote an NYPD blue spec.
And how was that received?
It got me an agent, although I sent it cold to 5 different agencies, and 4 of them didn't even want to meet me off of the spec script. And again, that's even after having the homicide produced. So it's a very, very tough to crack into the business, very, very tough to get an agent's attention. And only did I find out later, a little bit to my chagrin, that a friend of mine from the Washington Post had sort of put a bug in the ear of someone at CAA to look out for me. So it's all about, you know, if not for that, I could have fallen through the cracks there as well.
Right.
Because looking back on that spec script, you know, it didn't, you know, I was an amateur. It didn't set the world on fire. But once I got an agent, you're in the business. Things started happening from there.
But you also had a kind of confrontation with NYPD Blue writer David Milch, didn't you, that kind of brought you very much to his attention?
Yes, indeed. My first job was on picket fences on staff.
Mm-hmm.
And I moved from Washington to L.A. to work on picket fences in the fall of 94.
That's a show created by David Kelly.
Yes, indeed, and written almost entirely by David Kelly, which I quickly learned.
Is that right?
And quickly sort of made me think this may not be the place. You know, I moved out here to write. I'm in the business to write, and there were a number of writers, a staff of writers there simply not writing.
He's pretty legendary for, like, writing everything. He's always got a hand in it.
Yes, indeed. He's a magnificent specimen. I mean, a one in a billion creative talent. But at that time, he hadn't sort of come to, I guess, a sort of self-knowledge that he was going to write. Now he doesn't even hire other writers, which is good, you know, because he doesn't have people sitting around disappointed.
Right.
But at that time, he still had a full staff on Picket Fences and a full staff on Chicago Hope.
You were one of the people sitting around disappointed.
Yeah, and yeah. Feeling, you know, why doesn't Daddy love us, you know, concurrently, the Washington Post actually broke a story about David Milch making comments before a seminar of writers, and when he was asked why there are so few black writers in dramatic television. And at that time, there may have been 0, for all I know, in 94, because there aren't but a handful today. And Milch is a very free-speaking person, and he propounded his theory that blacks as a class tend to do poorly writing for a general audience because they can't get outside of their blackness, so they can't sort of write from within the mainstream.
Yikes.
Whereas, he said, Jews, on the other hand, are particularly well-suited for dramatic writing because they're both in and out of the mainstream culture. So they have that doubleness that makes them ideal drama writers.
He may as well have put a bullseye on his head.
Yeah, and he was quite surprised when, you know, all of a sudden Jesse Jackson is calling ABC and all these things.
Right.
For a good week there, it got pretty hairy, as well as his own black star James McDaniels getting in his face and saying, what's up with this?
Lieutenant Fancy on NYPD Blue.
Indeed. But I appreciate the fact that Milch spoke so openly about what I'm sure is goes unspoken among a lot of white producers.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they just don't have a lot of respect for black writers as a class. Perhaps it's because they just see so few. I mean, I talked to a guy at about the time that story broke. I talked to a writer, John Tinker, who'd been in the business 12 years, and he told me he had never read a script by a black writer.
And this is John Tinker, who worked on, like, Saint Elsewhere and tons of high-profile shows.
Indeed. Had never even seen one.
Wow.
So there was something going on. But the thing that really got my dander up was not that Milch dared to speak something so politically incorrect or even inflammatory. It was that in just a few months in Hollywood, I had seen with my own eyes that not every white writer on staff on these dramas is a competent writer.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, where are, you know, while we're engaging in these public discussions of black inadequacy, why does no one ever mention rampant white mediocrity? You know, mm-hmm. It was all around me. And I said, nobody ever talks about this. And that's the unspoken flip side of any discussion of affirmative action, is that the assumption that every white person who has a job has it because of merit and mm-hmm. has it because they're good and they deserve it. And that wasn't the case in journalism. It's not the case anywhere. And it's certainly not the case in Hollywood, where people, you know, hire their brother-in-laws, you know, and make them writers, or they hire their best friend's kid out of college. And that's how writing jobs are handed out on a lot of shows in Hollywood. So how dare he raise the issue of merit and black people not being able to cut it in a meritocracy. So I put all this energy into a letter that was as polite as I could write it, and sent it to David Milch, who I'd met briefly before and shook his hand before. But and off of that letter, you know, he invited me to breakfast, and we had an extraordinary frank discussion
mm-hmm.
over breakfast about all these issues. And we left that with him saying, you know, if you ever come available, I'll give you a freelance episode to write. And not too long after that, I left Picket Fences again because I wasn't able to write there, and took Milch up on his offer. And indeed, he came through, gave me an episode late in the second season. And I was hired on staff at the beginning of the third season
mm-hmm.
off based on the work I had done on that first freelance opportunity.
So you really felt after that breakfast, hey, this is a guy I can work with, despite what he said, the fact that he was so open and honest and upfront, this was a guy you could work with.
Well, it was a guy I wanted to work with, and only because, I mean, I had been such a fan of television,
mm-hmm.
and I respected him so much. I mean, that's part of what hurt me so much, is that I've got every episode of Hill Street Blues on tape.
Mm-hmm.
I know what an extraordinary writer David Milch is, and I also know that, you know, he's probably not encountered, you know,
right.
you know, a lot of black writers who could perform at a level that he could respect.
Mm-hmm.
So I just wanted to, as a writer, work with him. I was hoping that as a black man, or as a person with different experiences that I and different voices that I could bring to bear on the show, that he could value me as that. But I wanted primarily to try to impress him as a writer.
I'm talking with David Mills. Let's take a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest David Mills has written for such shows as NYPD Blue and ER. So you started out really writing for the cream of the TV crop. You were working with David Kelly, then producer Stephen Bochco, who reinvented the cop show with Hill Street Blues, and David Milch, who has this reputation for writing intricate, morally complex scripts. What advice or training did you receive from them that was helpful?
David Milch comes from a university background. He was a lecturer at Yale, and he was a protege of Robert Penn Warren. So he not only can write, he is a teacher
mm-hmm.
And loves that role, that pedagogical role, ever since he's been out in Hollywood. Still, his gift to me, when I look back on it and I draw on it every day, is just the standard he set for truth, for emotional and behavioral truth, and for truth of language, to the point where you really have to, I mean, you can't try to sneak anything by him. You can't, if anything is the least bit phony, you know, he's going to deal with it quite harshly. So he set an incredible standard. So by the time I really started to, after a few scripts, to really learn what I was doing, it just took a little bit of a kind word from him or a thumbs up from him to just really, you know, lift me, you know, into the clouds. Because if you impress him, you know, you've done something.
Mm-hmm.
And I still got rewritten a lot. Everybody gets rewritten a lot, by David, and by others. But all along the while, you know, I felt myself getting closer and closer, script by script, to what his vision and voice of that show were.
Initially, what role did you play in the writing of that show? And I wonder if, you know, just as on a show like this, you'd have a consultant on police work to make sure those details are right. Were you ever initially turned to sought out about the portrayal of blacks in an episode?
No, and I did not covet that role.
I'm sure, yeah.
It was a similar thing when I worked on the style section of the Washington Post. You know, I did not want... Other people are different and welcome this, but when I'm sitting in the newsroom, I don't want my colleague from across the newsroom to say, here, I've written this, my white colleague to come over and say, here, I've written this story on a black guy, and to sort of vet it through me.
Right.
You know, that's not the role I want to be in, just as I don't want to do that, you know, with a story I write to vet it to somebody else, or if I'm writing a script to vet it through the woman writer on staff. Say, do I have this woman quite right? If I had specific concerns, you know, I would draw on whatever I could, but just not as a general matter, of course. So, no, that was not done.
Yeah. It's just, you know, as an outsider looking at a show, you know, you never really know how many cooks are making that stew. You know, it's whether it really is a vision of a single writer a lot of the time.
Mm-hmm. Well, I've seen it both ways. When I went to ER, I saw a whole other side of how a drama could run.
Mm-hmm.
Because David Kelly and David Milch are kind of that same school of these kind of mad geniuses.
Mm-hmm.
And your only job is to do the best you can to mimic their voice and vision. Because these individuals, I mean, these universes sprang fully blown from the mind of David Kelly and David Milch. And it's not your job to come here and tell the stories you want to tell. No, you're there to tell the stories David Kelly wants to tell and David Milch wants to tell in the style that they have created. Now, ER was a totally different model. John Wells is a fine writer, but he is not invested in, he doesn't have the sense of ownership of that universe of ER.
Mm-hmm.
That Milch and Kelly have. Therefore, and he very much as a matter of philosophy or workplace culture, believes in collaboration, so that the writers meet, you know, 12 hours a week just beating out every story of every episode, so that in every episode, all the writers have a hand in somewhere, whether you threw out a funny line in the course of the story meeting and it wound up in the script, or, you know, you're giving notes to the first and second and final drafts of every script that's written, so that it was truly a collaborative process, and you can't argue against the success of that process with ER. It's an extraordinary hit.
Mm-hmm.
But you could probably say that it doesn't burn with the fire of an individual genius. But it's a superb show nonetheless, and it was a very satisfying place to work as a writer.
We're talking with writer David Mills, who's written episodes for NYPD Blue and ER. I want to backtrack a little and ask you why you left NYPD Blue. Did you have a falling out with Milch, or was it just you decided?
Of a sort. It was late in the fourth season, and there just came a time, I mean, I felt myself improving by leaps and bounds, script by script. But there came a time when I realized that as long as I was there on that show, my role was to be David Milch's, you know, student.
Mm-hmm.
And his role was to be my tutor. And I would never, you know, so there came a time where I felt...
It was time to graduate.
Indeed. In fact, one of the first things he told me when he hired me, I mean, because he knows that he is a complex and difficult personality. And one of the first things he told me says, you'll be here until the point where you tell me to go screw myself. Mm-hmm. And that point came, and then sort of late in the fourth season, out of no particular fight or anything, but just my sense that, you know, if I was there for another year or 2 years, I would always find myself standing there while he lectured me on the proper way to tell this particular story, as is his right to do. Again, that's his universe. Mm-hmm. So I left, and he allowed me to leave, and Stephen Bochco allowed me to leave, and I wound up on ER.
Just looking at those two shows, it seems to me as a viewer that the big difference in coming in there as a writer is in terms of the pacing and the number of storylines. Is that true?
Yeah, yeah. It exhausted me. I mean, an average script on NYPD Blue, as well as Picket Fences, I guess your average hour-long drama is like 60 pages. Mm-hmm. On ER, those have gotten up now to where the standard length is like 85 pages. Mm-hmm. So like, I'm kind of used to like when you hit page 50, you know, you're almost done. But on ER, you still got a lot more to go. It's because the thing moves so quick and you're telling 8 or 10 stories.
Right, as opposed to on NYPD Blue, it's like sort of three main storylines.
Three tops, yeah. And so it was fun. It was fun to try to do that and to tell that many stories economically in ER. Mm-hmm. And you could find ways, you know, to, if you were really cute, to double up on them. So a scene could be, you know, telling two stories at once, depending on the two characters who were in it and what was happening to them. So it was, it's tough storytelling because you got a lot of balls in the air. Mm-hmm. But when you pull it off, it's satisfying too for that.
David Mills, he wrote the teleplay for the episode of ER that airs tonight. He's also the co-author of a new book, George Clinton and P-Funk, An Oral History. I'm Ken Tucker, and this is Fresh Air.
For tapes or transcripts of Fresh Air, please call toll-free anytime, 1-888-NPR-NEWS. Also, Fresh Air interviews are now available online at www.audible.com/freshair.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, bugs, friends, foes, or three-course meals. We talk with the authors of a new book, Man Eating Bugs, The Art and Science of Eating Insects. Also, Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new collection of recordings by the pianist William Capel, who's receiving fresh recognition 45 years after his death. This is Fresh Air. I'm Ken Tucker. My guests, Peter Menzel and Faith DeLucio, have traveled to four continents and a dozen countries around the world, finding out what bugs people like to eat and why. The result is their book, Man Eating Bugs, The Art and Science of Eating Insects, filled with lovingly composed color portraits taken by Peter of people noshing on tarantulas, magay worms, and stink bugs, which, Faith remarks, are better than some worms I've tried. The text of the book is a kind of ongoing dialogue between the husband and wife team over their experiences, their motives for what they're doing, and their different degrees of adventurism, which is to say, who is more often the willing insect consumer and why? Peter Menzel and Faith DeLucio, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I think the yuck curiosity factor is very high in a subject like this. You know, how does one cook and eat things like stink bugs and tarantulas? And what was apparently a personal favorite, the witchetty grub, is that how you say it?
Right. Witchetty grubs in Australia were my personal favorite.
Yes. And why?
Why? I'm out in the outback in this very hot red central desert of Australia, and I'm with some Aboriginal women that are in their 50s. They're already grandmothers a couple times over, and we're walking around for several days looking for things to eat, and they showed me how to dig down when they found a witchetty tree that had been infected. The tree looks a little bit different than other trees, but it takes so long for your eyes to be able to see this. You need some kind of, you know, real knowledge of where you are. But they dig down, they break open the root after digging through this red hot hard soil for a foot and crack it open, and hopefully they'll find a witchetty grub, which is a white worm that's probably longer than your middle finger when they're really mature. So they then gather these up and cook them in the hot sand and ash at the edge of the fire, along with other things that they had caught during that day, like a 3-foot-long goanna that one of the women had killed with a shovel, and a kangaroo tail that they had bought at a quick stop and thrown in the fire also. But having eaten all those things, I can say that the witchetty grubs were very surprisingly delicious.
Now, you describe a stink bug as actually fighting back when you bit it.
Mm-hmm. That was my first.
Yeah, that was your first? And what was that sensation, to have something you bit into bite back?
Well, it was not very pleasant, because this was in Mexico, outside of Taxco, on top of a mountain, during a festival called the Humil Festival. And people from the entire state of Guerrero have the day off, and they go up to the top of this mountain, and there's bands and beer and people rustling around under the leaves looking for these stink bugs, which are very high in iodine and protein. So they have a medicinal factor too, and their taste is what's extraordinary. They taste like an aspirin that's been saturated with cod liver oil with really dangerous subcurrents of alcohol and iodine, right? So this thing is alive in my mouth, and it doesn't taste like anything. There's a lot of people eating these alive, and then most people are being more reasonable, and they're crushing them up in a mortar and pestle and putting them on a tostada with some chili and guacamole, because the flavor is really something else. So when this thing, I put it in my mouth, and everybody's watching me because I'm, you know, the foreign photographer up here as a guest. And so I couldn't let it get away. So I bit down on it, and it sort of exploded in my mouth. And the next thing I know, you've got this not too good a taste, but something that's crawling around in your tongue trying to do damage to the inside of your mouth. You want to terminate that very quickly.
I would imagine. How did you plan your route? Was there a plan? Did you have an itinerary in mind?
We had a general itinerary, but it was serendipity. For instance, while we were in China in Guangzhou in the market there, we met some people that were selling scorpions, raising them in their apartment. We went back and had scorpion soup with them. And then they finally, after they trusted us, they told us where they were getting their scorpions from. And that happened to be in East Central China. And
it was their parents, actually, who were raising these things. There were these giant scorpion ranches, we came to find out. And so we went to this East Central China town, which was actually pretty difficult to get to, Luoyang. And when we were there, it took about a day and a half to get anyone to trust us, because everyone was very fearful that we wanted to steal their business, mm-hmm. steal the secrets, because with the sort of the privatization of a lot of the companies in China that's coming, that is, scorpions are a very big business and very important. So we get in there, and this one place called the Boda Scorpion Ranch, and it's this very dark, clammy place, and you can hear before you see all these skittering little feet, and they are indeed scorpions. And come to find out, there are 3 or 4 million of them inside mm-hmm. this building, and it was a really surreal experience.
It's like a brick chicken coop that's the size of a football field full of 3 million scorpions that are moving around in the dark.
And they're being held there to do what?
They've domesticated them, and they're basically raising them there, mm-hmm. and then they are selling them for both food and medicine because it's a pretty integral part of Chinese traditional medicine.
Let me ask the kind of inevitable culinary imperialism question. It seems for the most part, it looks as if the people you ate bugs with who prepared them for you and showed you how they were harvested and caught seem to be living in extreme poverty. In rural areas of countries like Uganda and Indonesia, is it a matter of economic necessity rather than cultural preference to eat insects?
Quite often it is, but there are places where it's not the poor that are eating insects. A lot of developing countries, insects are eaten by poor people, and they're used as bridge food between harvests. It comes in very handy. And in places like Indonesia, it was probably one of the only sources of protein and fat. These sago grubs that we were eating with these people were integral to their diet. Mm-hmm. But in other places like China, the scorpions, for instance, are quite pricey. You can't find them anymore on street stalls. People used to sell them on the street, and now they're in trendier restaurants. Mm-hmm. So it's not a cheap dish to get a nice big plate of deep-fried scorpions anymore.
Did the people that you were eating bugs with ever feel as though they were being condescended to, that you were, approaching them as some kind of novelty?
When you're sharing food with people, all your differences are gone, at least until dessert. Mm-hmm. I mean, while you're eating with them, you're just another human being doing what human beings do to stay alive. You're ingesting basic, simple, pure animal protein, mm-hmm. which is what insects are.
And I'm the reluctant bug eater, it's actually very easy when you are sitting down to eat and you're sort of immersing yourself in this other culture that you're just learning about. It sort of helps to have these things that you're doing that are different, and mm-hmm. it becomes a little less improbable, mm-hmm. and you go ahead and you do it. But Peter was saying about, waiting until dessert for the differences to come out. We actually had that happen during a termite lunch when we were in South Africa. We had gone termite hunting with this group of ladies. We came to call them the Termite Club. And I was telling them they wanted to know what we eat, and I told them, and we talked about other places that we'd been, and I said we had just come from China, and I was telling them about eating scorpions. They were totally disgusted with me.
Huh.
And it's a lot like, in this country, talking about any insect, it's all cultural preference. Food preferences are definitely culturally based, obviously.
Yeah. And they're all usually set by the time you're 4 or 5 years old.
Right. My guests are Peter Menzel and Faith DeLucio. Let's take a short break. This is Fresh Air. I'm Ken Tucker. I'm talking to Peter Menzel and Faith DeLucio, and they've just published a book called Men Eating Bugs, The Art and Science of Eating Insects. I was interested in the chapters about North American bug-eating habits in the Southwest and Mexico, and you say things like grasshoppers in Utah have double or triple the protein content proportionally compared to the flesh of mammals and birds, and they're rich in vitamins. And you kind of imply that the only way that eating insects in America is making any inroads is kind of as novelty items, that you found a company that makes chocolate-dipped scorpions and candied apples covered with mealworms.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the Hot Licks company in Pismo Beach, California. They do a really big business.
But it is just for novelty.
It is, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But American Indians and people that are indigenous to the desert Southwest in America and Mexico used to eat a lot of insects, and it made a lot of economic sense. The people you were mentioning, Utah, for instance, around the Great Salt Lake, the Mormon crickets sometimes swarm, and when they are swarming, it's very easy to collect hundreds of pounds of these in a day. Sometimes they're windrowed along the Great Salt Lake shore, mm-hmm. and they're already salted, and they're blown up on the shore. So people have been able to collect more than 200 pounds in 1 hour of these windrowed, salted, dried grasshoppers, but they've done experiments when they've been alive, and it you know, 18 pounds an hour is about what the average person could collect. So that's equal to probably, you know, 43 Big Macs or 87 chili dogs or 49 slices of pizza. That's one study that's been done on the nutritional equivalent of what one person could collect in an hour.
Huh. And how are grasshoppers prepared, for instance?
For instance, in Oaxaca, beautiful colonial town, quite often, most of the year actually, grasshoppers are on the menu in a lot of good restaurants, and you can find them in the markets, girls and women selling chapulines, which are dried, and usually they put a little...
They're dried. Sometimes they're fried, stir-fried with a little bit of lemon juice. And you want to get them fresh, though, because they just keep adding lemon juice until they sell them all. So about when you're, if you're on the last, the last bucket full.
It's pretty sour.
It's pretty sour.
But we have a recipe for grasshopper tacos in the book, and we've had those in restaurants. But most often we saw people having them as snacks.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just eating handfuls of these things.
I mean, are they? It does seem like that when you say that they're prepared with guacamole and covered with a tortilla and things like mm-hmm. that, do they actually have enough taste that you can taste, or are you only tasting the taco or the guacamole?
They have a taste, but it's very subtle, and it's kind of woody. They taste a little bit like straw, actually.
Mm-hmm.
But good straw.
Sounds like what all health foods taste like to me.
A lot of fiber there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Do you think that a lot of our culture's squeamishness derives from our eating food that doesn't resemble the animal that we're eating, the way food is packaged?
That is so true. I like to say, and I've probably said it too much now because I'm always having to make excuses for the fact that I didn't enjoy eating bugs as much as Peter did. But I'm really comfortable with getting my protein on a slab of styrofoam covered in saran wrap. And I don't really know what my food looks like. I mean, I don't make the connection between this slab of beef and the cow in the field next door.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's true of a lot of things. I'm not real comfortable eating crawdads, you know, in Louisiana. I like all the stuff that comes with it. I like the spices and everything else, but it looks too much like a bug.
Mm-hmm.
And indeed, it's a member of the same family.
Right. Did you come across any bugs that were eaten as hallucinogens in any way?
Well, not really, but while we were eating roasted tarantulas in Venezuela. We were on the Orinoco River with the Yanomamis in their village. We were in a hut, and these boys were cooking this Teraposa leblandi for us, which is the world's largest spider. It's bigger, much bigger than your hand outstretched. So we caught some of these, they threw them on the fire, and they're cooking. So the spiders are sort of hissing and whistling on the fire. And in the next hut are a group of men who are taking shaman 101.
We're practicing shamanism.
So they've got yopo, powdered
it's
hallucinogen, an herb.
Mm-hmm.
That they're blowing up each other's noses with these long pipes. And once it goes up your nose, it apparently causes tremendous pain before the good effects kick in. So these guys are howling and retching and whooping it up. And then for the next couple of days, we had to avoid them because they were flying all over the village.
But that was a long way around that
one. The people, not the bugs, were flying
so,
around the
so were. To answer your question, we did not have any hallucinogenic bugs that we know of.
But I do know that, and this was the part that amused me the most, is that in every culture we visited, there was at least one story about insects being good for a man's virility.
Really?
And definitely in Cambodia, the woman on the front cover,
mm-hmm.
Suk Kun, she was 21 years old, and she and a bunch of her friends were selling these deep-fried tarantulas on skewers, and I never saw a woman buy them. And she told me the reason was because men say that they're good for virility.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. So this is the Viagra of other cultures.
Right.
You've brought along a couple of tins of insects here. Are any of these things I could
sure, this is... This is
reluctantly, but...
wait, let me get a nice, fat, juicy one. They're not juicy. These are mopani worms mm-hmm. from Botswana,
mm-hmm.
and they're harvested off of the mopani tree.
Mm-hmm.
They're really very beautiful when they're alive, all the beautiful bright
yellow
oranges
and
yellows.
And black and green.
And what they do is they squeeze the guts out, which are bright green
mm-hmm.
and kind of smelly, and it's basically all the leaf material that they've eaten.
Mm-hmm.
And then they... put it in boiling salty water for quite a while.
I see.
And they let it dry, and That's what that is. It's sort of like jerky. It's very salty.
Mm-hmm. Per unit weight, it has three times the protein of beef, and this keeps for up to a year.
I was going to say, is this fairly fresh, or am I getting a very dry?
Well, I said up to a year. I used to say up to 6 months, and then that expired, so now we're saying up to a year.
No, actually, they're not bad, and I would break it in half, and don't eat the head in your first bite.
I was just going to say, does it matter whether I eat the head or the tail? Mm-hmm. Okay, I'll eat the...
They're very woody.
That's the head. Turn it around.
Oh, see? Mm-hmm. Here I go. Instinctively, I'm heading for the wrong end of the bug. Thanks. Okay, here we go. It's not bad. Mm-hmm. It's more like a grape nut, sort of.
Or a little like a salty grape nut.
A woody, woody beer nut.
Mm-hmm. I think I need a couple of pork rinds to wash it down, but... Well, thank you.
Oh, you're welcome.
Thank you.
I appreciate it. Peter Menzel and Faith DeLucio, authors of Man-Eating Bugs. You'd expect us to play some ridiculous yet clever bug music now, but instead we'll preview our debugged concert tomorrow with Kate and Anna McGarrigle, Loudon Wainwright, and Kate and Loudon's children Rufus and Martha. Here they are singing Irving Berlin's What'll I Do?
What'll I do when you are far away and I am blue? What'll I do?
What'll I do when I am wondering who is kissing you? What'll I do?
What'll I do?
The McGarrigles and a couple of generations of Wainwrights who'll join us for more lovely music and an interview tomorrow. Coming up, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz celebrates a neglected pianist, the late William Capel. A 9-CD collection of his work has just been released. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. pianist William Capel was killed in a plane crash on October 29, 1953. He was 31 years old. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz says that Capel was the most gifted American pianist of his time.
After his fatal plane crash, William Capel was largely forgotten, except by aficionados. Most of his recordings went out of print. Finally, 45 years after his death, not only are all of his commercial recordings available again, but also important live performances and a fascinating collection of outtakes and fragments, including repertoire he never recorded in the studio. Capel was known primarily for super romantic music, Chopin and a lot of Russians. He actually had hit records of the Kachaturian Piano Concerto and Rachmaninoff's Variations on a Theme of Paganini. I still have my little red 45 RPM single of the lyrical 18th variation, and it still holds up. Chopin also holds up. The Funeral March Sonata, from a live concert he gave in Australia just a week before his death, is both sweeping and intimate, impetuous and restrained, rhythmically inexorable, all the more moving for its refusal to milk emotions. It seems to well up from some deep, private place. He was a technician of such brilliance, he's often thought of as a brash American, all dazzle. But Capel was never vulgar. There's a flame behind the dazzle. These 9 discs show him reaching out to a greater variety of repertoire than he's usually credited for. It makes a difference. Capel's Bach is a revelation, with its startling pre-Glenn Gould crispness and a musical line of irresistible liquidity and grace. I'd never have guessed how witty he could be, and in works as different as Debussy's Children's Corner Suite and Mussorgsky's Pictures at an Exhibition. Who'd have predicted such loving Mozart and enchanting Scarlatti, or Schubert played with such elegance and charm? In concert, Capel championed contemporary American composers, but never recorded any. RCA has unearthed a radio broadcast of a stunning concert at the Frick Collection, 8 months before he died, in which Capel gives a powerful, unbuttoned performance of a work he cherished, Aaron Copland's Piano Sonata. The quiet ending is one of the most heartfelt passages in the entire set. Capel was quite a complicated character. Intensely self-conscious and self-critical, he was also a matinee idol. The liner notes include beefcake photos of him stretched out on a diving board in a bathing suit, showing off his trimness and James Dean-like good looks. Or he's in an apron cooking breakfast, sitting at the keyboard with his new wife, or surrounded by children competing for the piano competition he sponsored. Interviewed by a pretentious New York radio interviewer, Capel is full of nervous intelligence and not without a trace of his own pretensions. But there's no question he was an artist of the highest order, already at 31, our greatest homegrown virtuoso, paving the way for other Americans like Leon Fleischer and Van Cliburn. Even these extraordinary, fully achieved recordings, thank God we have them, are hardly sufficient consolation for such immeasurable potential so irretrievably cut short.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed the 9-volume William Capel edition on the RCA Red Seal label. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Naomi Person, Phyllis Myers, and Amy Sallet, with Alan Tu, Monique Nazareth, and Anne-Marie Baldonado. Research assistance from Sam Adams. Our engineer today was Bob Purdick. In for Terry Gross, I'm Ken Tucker.